I'm Jonathan Agnew, and this is Rebel Rebel on the BBC World Service. Over the next hour, we'll look back at the Rebel cricket tours to South Africa in the 1980s. Rebel, Tom Cartwright's dodgy shoulder may have been the catalyst, but the so-called D'Oliveira affair had been years in the making. Born in Cape Town, Basil was raised under the South African system of racial separation called apartheid. He was classed as neither white nor black, but Cape coloured, meaning his whole life, everything from where he lived to his education, was dictated by the colour of his skin.
As I watched the test matches, I thought, my goodness, why can't I play at that level? And I thought, well, the only place I could think of was England, and John Harlett's voice is the thing. And that's all I remember of the fact that I heard this man's voice and the way he described the game. And I thought, well, he's the man I'm going to write to, which I did.
Harlett arranged for D'Oliveira to come to England, and Basil never looked back. Stints in the Lancashire League led to a contract with Worcestershire, and then, after becoming a British citizen, a place in the England team. But his selection in 1968 to face the country of his birth, after initially being controversially dropped, would light the fuse for decades of sporting boycotts. South Africa had only ever played test matches against the white nations, England, Australia and New Zealand. And the South African government, led by Prime Minister B.J. Forster, made it abundantly clear it would not accept a team featuring a non-white player.
I now say on behalf of South Africa, whereas we were always prepared to play host to the MCC, we are not prepared to receive a team thrust upon us.
The tour was cancelled. Apartheid was now front-page news, and the anti-apartheid movement became fully aware of the power of sport in their battle to cause change in South Africa. Demonstrators targeted other cricket tours and other sports, most notably rugby, and bolstered by support from governments around the world, especially from the Caribbean, in 1977 came the Gleneagles Agreement. It wasn't legally binding, but it urged the signatories to discourage contact by their nationals with sporting organisations, teams or sportsmen from South Africa. South Africa became a sporting island. While apartheid remained, it was isolated from the fields, pitches, courts and tracks of international sport. By 1981, South Africa hadn't played a test series in well over a decade, and England, like most of the cricketing world, was being humbled by the great West Indian side that featured a bowling attack that wasn't just quick, as downright life-threatening.
He's on his way in, bowls, and again, it takes off and whistles through across the front of Botham's face. Botham gives a gesture of disgust, throws down his bat, and the crowd don't think much of that.
John Embry was part of that England team that faced the likes of Holding, Croft, Garner and Marshall.
We went to the West Indies in 1981 and that was a very tough tour and some quick bouncy wickets, and it wasn't an enjoyable tour. The West Indies were pretty ruthless in the way they approached their cricket at the time, and pretty daunting, a lot of short pitch bowling. And there's this South African guy, Peter Cook, came out to Guyana. And I suppose the roots of that South African tour in 82 really took root in Guyana during the West Indies tour of 81.
Peter Cook was a record producer with business links to England batsman Jeff Boycott. He sounded out the England team about the prospect of what was called a private tour to South Africa. Initially, nothing came of the idea, and England, helped by a Herculean effort by Sir Ian Botham, won the Ashes in the summer of 1981 and then headed off to India.
The cricket in India was turgid. I got left out because of the bad decisions, and we played the extra batsman, so I was a little bit annoyed and disappointed with the situation. Obviously, I came back and played another couple of test matches at the back end of that series, and it was then that we got this call about, well, it's going to go ahead. Are you still interested to go?
The pieces were falling into place. Players like John Embry and Graham Gooch were recruited, although some of the bigger names of English cricket, like Botham, Gatting and Gower, turned down the offer, and the money came via a sponsorship with South African breweries. Incredibly, the tour was still a secret. Even the South African players were unaware of what was going on. Clive Rice was a gritty, hard-playing South African all-rounder who also played for Nottinghamshire.
Suddenly, we were told that the team had arrived and the Springboks were now going to play, because Graham Gooch's Rebels had arrived, and this was going to happen. You know, I had no idea that that was happening until literally when they arrived at what was Jan Smuts Airport then. That's how I found out.
This is a major breakthrough for South African sport, and the English players arrived in a blaze of publicity. These cricketers will give the Springboks their first taste of international cricket in well over 10 years. The South Africans are cock-a-hoop about the visit. As one official put it, this is just what South Africa needs.
The England team, or the South African Breweries 11 as it was known, featured Jeff Boycott, Graham Gooch, Dennis Amiss, Alan Knott, Derek Underwood, John Lever, Wayne Larkins, Peter Willey, Mike Hendrick, Chris Old, Arnold Sidebottom, Bob Woolmer, Jeff Humpage, my old roommate Les Taylor, and John Embry.
I chatted with Graham Gooch about it because he's my best mate. I think he was very disappointed with the way things went in India and the way the cricket was played and the way the cricket was internationally at that time. The actual tour took place at the end of a tour and before the county cricket season started. So we felt that, well, we got no contract with the board, we got no contract with our club. There shouldn't be any objection. To me, it was a job. There was no political angle in it. I didn't look at it that way. I just looked, right, I'm going to play cricket, I'm being paid for it, and that was it.
By resorting to offering hard cash to players to tour, the South African cricket authorities showed new tactics in ensuring international cricket would return to the country. André Odendaal is a former first-class cricketer, a Cambridge Blue, author, historian and chief executive officer of the Western Province Cricket Association.
The attempt to continue the rebel tours was also, A, to provide cricket for people who hadn't played for 10 years through isolation, but also to break the boycott which was hurting apartheid. The South African Cricket Union worked with the government, P.W. Botha's government, in arranging that tours would be 100% tax deductible sponsorship for tours, so that the tours actually took part as part of the government's foreign policy strategy to stay in control. There was also a change in the cricket mentality or culture in South Africa at that stage, in the establishment, that up until 1980, it had been the old school tight types like Boone Wallace and Billy Whiddon and Jack Cheatham, who tried to prevail on their friends at Lord's to, you know, do the decent thing. We are trying to change, play with us. But from 1981 onward, we saw the beginning of commercialization of South African cricket. So Ali Bacher was the first CEO to be appointed in 1981. And the strategy that was followed to almost buy South African cricket, international cricket for South Africa, was also part of that culture that was developing.
If the rebels thought their actions would go unnoticed, they were soon to be disappointed. In the media, they were dubbed mercenaries, rebels and traitors. And condemnation came from other cricketing nations.
Sunil Gavaskar has accused five England players of flouting assurances they gave before touring India. He says they should have respected their word. Gavaskar believes this summer's tour should be cancelled if any of the players in South Africa are selected for England. Jeffrey Boycott is seen as the villain here. 3 months ago, warm-hearted crowds applauded him enthusiastically when he became the world's highest scorer in test matches. Many of them now believe Boycott left India early to organise the team for South Africa. Boycott's assurance that he opposed apartheid made the tour of India possible. India's cricket board president S.K. Wankhede says this summer's return tour is now in danger.
The TCCB, the then governing body of English cricket, had this to say.
Of course one is concerned. Our clear policy in the board is that we do not play international cricket with South Africa at the present time. And the players are quite aware of this and they are doing this with their eyes open.
The rebels are rumoured to have been paid between £40,000 to £60,000 per player, a fortune for a cricketer back in the 1980s, but many felt the money was tainted. The MP, Gerald Kaufman, made clear his views.
To what the Gleneagles Agreement describes as the abomination of apartheid are selling themselves for blood-covered Kruger Rands. I beg to move.
The tour brought into focus the relationship between Great Britain and South Africa, and also the debate over the right and freedom of the individual to earn a living.
Mr. Nicholas Winterton, Would my right honourable friend take time today to tell the people of this country that any law-abiding citizen of this nation has the right to travel where they want to and when they want to? Whether they be holidaymakers, businessmen, sportsmen, including cricketers, and that it surely, Mr. Speaker, is right that we should seek to help a country that is friendly to the West and to the Prime Minister of that country, which is carrying through a very progressive programme, rather than handing over Southern Africa to our enemies.
While the newspapers screamed with condemnation, the politicians bickered, and the cricketing authorities decided what to do, back in South Africa, the players accused of taking blood-stained Krugerrands were preparing to play against a South African team featuring the likes of Mike Proctor, Barry Richards, Graham Pollock and Clive Rice.
The first game was played at St George's Park in Port Elizabeth, and we went up, drove up to the ground in the morning, and there was no traffic. We thought, my goodness, this is a disaster, you know, no one's supporting it. We got there. We were the last to arrive in the stadium. 7 o'clock the gates opened. The queues had started from 6 o'clock in the morning so they could get their seats. When we walked into the stadium, my goodness, we got a huge cheer. And you just sort of thought, no, the support was absolutely phenomenal.
For the Rebels, the tour was beginning to turn into a nightmare. The TCCB had passed judgment on their actions. John Embry.
I think that was a key word, maybe banned. But that telegram arrived at lunchtime on the first day of our first match. So it arrived 2 or 3 hours too late. But by then, it would have been too late anyway. Contracts were signed. And I think once you're at the ground and you're preparing, even if the telegram had arrived then, the players would have gone ahead and played their cricket.
For the record, South Africa won both the one day and the so-called Test Series. But the significance was not so much the results on the field, but that South Africa was once again playing some kind of international sport. On returning to the UK, the Rebels became quickly aware of the storm awaiting them.
The smiles were strained. Most had come home a day early. Some suggested it was to avoid publicity. But as the players wouldn't comment about anything, it was difficult to find out. They had certainly remained on the aircraft until the other passengers had left, and there had been an attempt to get them off the airport without meeting the press. Graham Gooch, the team captain, maintained his silence on any matters other than cricket.
Mr. Gooch, BBC Radio News. Can we just ask...
Excuse me.
Can we just welcome you back to England and ask you...
Thank you.
Have you any regrets about going on the tour?
Cricket was good.
The Rebels were headline news and the main defendants in the court of public opinion. Plus, there was a small matter of a ban on playing international cricket hanging over them. In the spring of 1982, the proposed ban was to be voted on by the PCA, the Professional Cricketers Association. Attending the PCA meeting at Edgbaston in Birmingham back then was a young cricketer who had his roots in South Africa.
My parents emigrated from South Africa in 1958, and they were what was classified as Cape Coloured. They came to England, and obviously due to apartheid and the increasingly difficult situation they were getting as non-whites in Cape Town, and they emigrated here in 58 with my two young sisters, and then I was born here in 1960.
Nigel Felton would go on to play first-class cricket for Somerset and Northamptonshire, but back in 1982 he was a fresh-faced youngster still seeking his big break in the game.
I hadn't played first-class cricket yet. I knew quite a few people whose kids had all grown up playing youth cricket, but I hadn't played first-class, and I just stated who I was, what my background was, and that I felt that, they had gone to South Africa, they'd gone to a country where most people couldn't live and work and marry and choose what they're doing because of the colour of their skin. And therefore, unfortunately, the ban was really the only way to go.
In the end, the professional players supported the TCCP's decision to ban the Rebels from international cricket for 3 years, but they could still play for their counties.
At the end of 3.5 hours of discussion, they knew. The meeting voted by 190 votes to 35 to support the ban imposed by the Test and County Cricket Board, in effect rejecting the players who went to South Africa.
Back in South Africa, the search began for another team prepared to tour. Arosa Sri Lanka, featuring a handful of capped Sri Lankan players, were the next visitors. But the cricket was poor, the public disinterested, and the players, though well paid, received 25-year bans for their troubles, a draconian sentence compared to the English Rebels. But in the early 1980s, the main prize for those organising the tours weren't teams made up of ageing Englishmen or inexperienced Sri Lankans. The team everyone wanted to see was the awesome West Indians.
Ball! Legs up out of the ground.
Holding, Marshall, Lloyd, Garner, Croft, Haynes, Greenidge and Richards. These players were the best and pure box office. Secret negotiations to bring them to South Africa began.
At the time, the representative would have been Dr. Ali Bakker, who would have been the one who approached me and about what they were trying to achieve, and I think he came to Taunton.
In 1982, Sir Vivian Richards was the gum-chewing, steely-eyed, coolest dude in cricket. He was an integral part of the all-conquering Windies and also turned out for Somerset in the county championship. Dr. Ali Bakker was the former South African captain who was attempting to lure a rebel West Indian team to his homeland. Bakker claimed to have interest from several well-known cricketers, but he wanted Sir Viv and was prepared to pay the price.
Quite a substantial fee. It would have made me quite comfortable. But these are decisions made. I was pretty conscious about my beliefs, and you had our brothers and sisters suffering in that part of the world, and so many inhumane stuff which was happening that I could not see myself being involved.
Vivian Richards decided not to go, and ultimately some of the other big names like Malcolm Marshall and Gordon Greenidge also declined, so the net was widened.
I'd been having some very productive years in the English leagues.
Franklin Stevenson was yet another tall fast bowler from the West Indies production line of super quicks.
Basically, I'd been seen. I think I was creating a lot of recognition from a lot of people at that time.
Franklin, like many others in his position, weighed up the pros and cons of touring South Africa.
It was a bit of a tough decision to make at the time, but I always saw that where we were concerned, it was always going to be a tour that was more than cricket. You know, I always saw South Africa as a nation of 28 million black people and 4 million white people, and the black people not having a voice. But here in the Caribbean, I knew that our best product was our cricket. That was a universal language, and, you know, we had so much to offer. I believed that it could be exported, you know, to do good. And I turned up to the next day, the team had left, and I know they got the jeers. I thought you'd left Barbados. I heard that you were touring South Africa and so on. I just smiled and I continued my practice. But then after the practice, the coach called me back into the nets. He proceeded to give me a lecture. And after about, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes or so, I still was wondering, what was this guy talking about, you know? I was accused of being powerful. And in our words, that means outspoken. I'm trying to get my head around what the matter is, you know, and it was just sort of mind-boggling. I'm walking away from him, still wondering what was going on, and I'm thinking, you know, well, these guys are offering me and begging me to be a part of something, and I'm here in Barbados trying hard to, you know, just do the basics. Also, the night we went home, I was standing, you know, just chatting with my guys, and everybody's got an opinion, and I really thought that I had something to offer to that team. It needed a linchpin. And I decided, you know what, I'm going to do this. And I went home and I made a call and told my chain of mind that I'm going to go on the tour. And they came and got me very early the next morning, and I was on the plane, and the rest is history.
17 black West Indian cricketers are due to arrive in South Africa for the start of a rebel tour which could threaten the future structure of the international game. The 17, including five current test players, are said to be receiving between £60,000 and £75,000 a man to play in a country which has been banned from international cricket since 1970 because of its apartheid policies. News of the tour has been met with dismay among black leaders. The Commonwealth Secretary General, Sir Shridath Ramphal, described it as an act of shame and treachery, while the former Jamaican Prime Minister, Michael Manley, said the rebel players were mercenaries and traitors to the liberation struggle of the South African people. By going to South Africa, they have effectively written off their test careers. They're certain to be banned, perhaps for life. Some will fare better than others. Sylvester Clark, for instance, plays for Surrey during our summer, and he'll be able to continue with his English county commitments. Others, though, will find themselves ostracised in the West Indies and may yet regret the decision to go to South Africa.
For those West Indians in South Africa, the threat to the stability of world cricket was not their problem. There was a more immediate concern. Franklin Stevenson.
The thing is, I got to the airport and I actually saw two guys change their minds on the aircraft and they wanted this aircraft to turn back when they heard about reports of what was being printed in the media and so on and said, you know. We got to the airport before we landed, actually. We're going to have 9 slips because all of a sudden nobody's going to the boundary because the reports were that, oh, we're going to be shot at and people would throw things at us or all this nonsense, you know.
The irony of this tour was that here was a team of black cricketers playing in a country where the black population was subjugated by apartheid. To overcome this anomaly, the South African authorities granted the tourists honorary white status. Clive Rice.
That was the stupidity of apartheid. It didn't work. Granting people so-called white status, you say, who are you fooling? A guy's a human being, he's come to play cricket, and he happens to be a black guy, and he can play. And also, what it did for the, I think, for the white public, was they had guys like Sylvester de Klerk and Israel Mosley and Lawrence Rowe, all as heroes. So the first time, suddenly, you had a black guy who was a hero of white kids, and the black guys could play cricket, and apartheid was made to look a fool in terms of what was going on.
Franklin Stevenson.
We were all young black liberalists, in a sense, you know, but what was our weapon? Our weapon was going to be the sport that we were gifted with. You know, wherever I went, I not that I actually opened out to make a statement in any way, I just played the sport to the height of my ability and fitness at the time, and it was respectful of everybody and everything around, and you know, it grew like that. Unfortunately, it didn't grow much at home somehow, but I'm sure it was respected wherever else I went.
But the argument that cricket was being used as a weapon against apartheid is dismissed by André Odendaal.
The whole idea was to show that South Africa was moving towards being an inclusive society and that it was actually a decent place. And it was still trying to sell itself as a democracy, which no one today claims it was. So the West Indies coming was actually very, very significant. It was a major anti-sanctions moment, I would say. So to actually break that growing sanctions call at a time when apartheid was under pressure was a major foreign policy coup, I would say, for the regime and also for the cricket establishment to feel now we've got a black team here. Also, perhaps honeycoated their attempt to sell themselves when it was actually a very marginal beginnings of multiracialism that we were seeing. So even though there might have been people with integrity who loved the game, by ignoring the political context, they were actually being part of the problem rather than the solution.
Weekends on the BBC World Service.
On a sunny June morning 100 years ago, a would-be assassin seized his moment on a Sarajevo street.
As the car came abreast, he stepped forward from the curb. He drew his automatic pistol from his coat and fired 2 shots. The first struck the wife of the Archduke in the abdomen. The second bullet struck the Archduke close to the heart.
Those 2 bullets, fired by a South Slav nationalist in 1914, killed the Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife and set in motion a series of events that changed the world we live in. I'm Alan Little, and I'm in Bosnia for the first in a series debating the legacy and enduring relevance of the First World War. I'll be joined by historians Bojan Aleksov and Amir Duranovic and an audience at the Sartre War Theatre in Sarajevo. The war that changed the world. Online at bbcworldservice.com.
Still to come on Rebel Rebel, we discover what happened to those who risked all to go on the Rebel tours. But first, a brief summary of the news.
BBC News, I'm John Shea.
Commemorations are taking place today to mark the centenary of the assassination in Sarajevo of the heir to the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which sparked a chain of events that would lead to the First World War. The descendants of Archduke Franz Ferdinand will be attending a service in memory of the war dead at the family castle near Vienna. The Bosnian capital, Sarajevo, is hosting a concert by the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra. The Vice President of Argentina, Amado Boudou, has been indicted on charges of corruption. Mr. Boudou is accused of abusing his power when he was Minister of the Economy to take control of the company that prints Argentina's banknotes. He's repeatedly denied any wrongdoing. Thailand's military ruler has announced the formation of a new National Assembly and an interim government within the next 2 months. General Prayut Chan-o-cha also said a new constitution would be drafted in a year's time to be followed by democratic elections. But the BBC Bangkok correspondent says it's clear that the military will keep tight control until then, with officers taking half of the seats in the assembly. The Ukrainian government's unilateral ceasefire in the east of the country appears to be holding, but there are reports of continued attacks by pro-Russia separatists. The airfield at Kramatorsk and two other military targets are said to have come under fire. European leaders have promised to address Britain's concerns about the future of the European Union after nominating Jean-Claude Juncker as the next European Commission president. The Swedish Prime Minister told the BBC it was vital for Britain to stay and that he would walk the extra mile to secure the reforms it wants. The influential American soul singer and songwriter Bobby Womack has died. He was 70. In a career spanning more than 50 years, Bobby Womack had a string of hits, including Across 110th Street and It's All Over Now. BBC News.
This is Rebel Rebel on the BBC World Service, a look back at the Rebel cricketers to South Africa during the 1980s. As you heard before the news, the West Indian rebels who decided to go to the Republic were widely condemned across the Caribbean. But Sir Viv Richards understands why some chose to go.
Well, I've always said that it's never my decision for me to be judge and jury. They went for whatever reasons, and that's their business. And I'm not going to condemn anyone. I was also, from maybe my point of view, you can say, okay, they got lured into something which morally, in a big way, wasn't right. But that's not going to be my call. I'm not going to get into the way I'm going to condemn and all that stuff, no.
Whether it was the money, the lack of opportunity to break into the dominant West Indian team of the time, or the chance to make a political statement, each player had his own reasons for going. Unlike the previous Rebel tours, the visit of the West Indians was deemed a success. Bumper crowds had seen competitive cricket, with South Africa winning the one-day series 4-2, while the so-called Test series was drawn 1-1. But the tourists had paid a heavy price. A lifetime ban on all cricket in the Caribbean. Sir Viv Richards.
I guess the West Indies Cricket Board at the time, or the people who were making decisions, were pretty harsh by banning them for life. That, to me, was a little harsh in many ways.
With a lifetime ban from cricket and dissenting voices back home, it's perhaps unsurprising that the rebel West Indians returned for a second tour. This time the tourists would be victorious and, according to Franklin Stevenson, they became even more popular with the home crowd.
Peter Kirsten, in the second leg of the tour, after the test match at Kingsmead, he'd had enough and he came out and he just complained, almost cried to the press. He said, this is weird. He said, my team, the Springbok team, has no support. So you imagine that this is apartheid and this is, you know, don't deal with these people. They hate black people and this and that. And we got a black team playing against their national side and their national captain has occasioned a complaint to the press that he has no support on the field of play. That's what they saw. That's the beauty that they saw.
Following in the footsteps of England, Sri Lanka and the West Indies, between 1985 and 87, an Australian team twice headed to the Republic. Like those before them, they were well paid and also received bans from cricket for their troubles. However, it's worth noting the severity of those bans were more akin to those dished out by the English authorities rather than those in the Caribbean or Sri Lanka. The Aussies got 2 to 3 years. Compare and contrast to the lifetime and 25-year bans dished out to the West Indians and Sri Lankans. But after the Australians had returned home, there was a pause in the rebel tours. Had the novelty worn off? Perhaps. Was there a recognition that real test cricket couldn't be replicated? Maybe. One undeniable truth was that South Africa was in turmoil, with repeated states of emergency being declared. It's also worth noting that by the mid-80s, the anti-apartheid struggle had a much higher profile than when the first English team had gone on their private cricket tour back in 1981. The music world especially had brought the situation in South Africa to the charts. But after a brief hiatus, the concept of another rebel tour was back on the agenda. John Embury.
I went out to South Africa to play golf, and I was down in Cape Town playing with about eight or nine other older former England cricketers. I got a phone call out of the blue from Ali Bucker asking me whether there might be interest in another tour taking place. And I said, well, yeah, I suppose I presume so. We had a brief chat. And I made some inquiries when I came back home to players about whether there would be interest in going, and there was a very positive response to that. So I informed him that, yeah, there's quite a bit of interest in the team going back out again.
Nigel Felton remembers when news of another potential rebel tour started doing the rounds.
Frankly, there were players falling over themselves to get asked to go. We all knew there was, you know, meetings in car parks, there was talk, and there were players who were desperate to get the call and they were disappointed when they didn't.
Certainly, as a county cricketer at the time, I was aware that rumours were rife. And one of those who did get the call was England and Kent bowler Richard Ellison.
I can't remember how that approach was made, whether it was David Graveney or whether it was somebody else. I'm not sure, because all I know was finding the captain, which was quite critical, it needed to be a profile name, by all accounts, and then communication was made. I'm pretty sure it probably was Graveney or Embury. I think John Embury was involved, having previously been over on the first trip.
Speaking 25 years after the event, Richard is remarkably honest about the reasons for going on the tour.
The reason I went was for the money. I was at a stage of my career, and even before the invitation came, I knew what I was going to do if that invitation did come. And I could say I had injuries and I wasn't sure what my career was going to be. I was a number of years off a potential benefit with Kent. I was married and all the other bits. It's easy to put these things or say these things. I'd married, I had a mortgage and all that sort of thing. Bottom line was, I went for the money.
John Embury is similarly candid about his motives.
I think probably afterwards, when I came back, I realised it probably wasn't the right decision to make. I made that decision financially. I wasn't bowling particularly well. I didn't feel that my international career was... that there were going to be too many test matches for me, because I wasn't bowling particularly well. And at the age of 37, was I going to get that back? But having accepted to go and sign a contract, then I was committed to going, and then you see it through.
The second England rebel tour featured, alongside Embury and Ellison, Bill Athey, Kim Barnett, Chris Broad, Chris Cowdery, Graham Dilley, Neil Foster, Bruce French, Paul Jarvis, Matthew Maynard, Tim Robinson, Greg Thomas, Alan Wells, Captain Mike Gatting and David Graveney. All of them knew they would be banned from cricket following an ICC edict announced earlier in 1989.
By proposing test match bans of up to 5 years, the ICC have opted for compromise, taking the middle ground between the lifetime bans proposed by the West Indies and the wishes of the England delegation that there should be no restrictions on cricketers who seek to supplement their earnings by playing or coaching in South Africa. Announcing the resolution, the ICC president, Lord Bramall, said it had been made with the aim of preserving the future of Test cricket. It was a realistic decision, but was it a surrender to pressure from the Black Nations?
Nobody has surrendered to anything. What the ICC have done is that they have faced up to certain realities, and they have come to the conclusion unanimously that this decision is the one that is going to keep international cricket from now on free from any uncertainty which has been hanging over it for the last few years.
News of the tour came to light during that summer's disastrous Ashes series.
Midsummer, when it actually broke that a tour was going to take place, it sort of broke midway through the test match at Old Trafford. And it may have been the fourth or fifth morning. And it was a difficult situation for me because I was actually batting at the time and trying to help save a test match. I remember Neil Foster bowling and he was quite emotional. And sort of tears in his eyes while he was bowling. It was very, very difficult for him, I think. And the reaction from the crowd wasn't necessarily bad. I don't think it was bad. I can't remember being booed or anything like that. I just think one of shock as much as anything else.
With the tour in the public domain, it was left to the captain Mike Gatting and the de facto spokesperson for the team, David Graveney, to front up to the press.
We had demonstrations in the West Indies when the England team were out there last time. I'm sure there'll be demonstrations when we get out there.
How much are they paying you, Mr. Gatting? How much are they paying you to go to South Africa? What's the blood money like in South Africa? You're going to get a nice new car out of this, Mr. Gatting. You're going to get a yacht out of this, a second home, Mr. Yachting. You're going to get lots of nice perks for the rest of your life on the backs of the blacks of South Africa. You're going to get a lot of money out of this, Mr. Gatting. I hear you're going to get about £200,000 out of this, Mr. Gatting.
Sorry, gentlemen, but unfortunately we can't continue.
What do you think of apartheid, Mr. Gatting?
Yes.
What do you think of apartheid?
Are they,
what do you think of? What do you think of apartheid, Mr. Gatting?
Somebody would like to go and get them.
I hear you. You have decided that you're going to go there and form your own opinion, Mr. Gatting. But you won't read any books about it. You won't listen to anybody. You wouldn't listen, watch the television programme, would you, about that? What was going on in South Africa?
The architect of the tour was once again Ali Bakker, the head of the South African Cricket Union. And he explained to the BBC's Nick Worrell why, after a pause of a few years, rebel players were now returning to South Africa.
We came over to England in July. We'd asked for a hearing with the ICC. The ICC, and with support from the Test and County Cricket Board, you know, were not in a position to even give us an unofficial hearing. So it became very apparent to us in that basically we're on our own and therefore we've got to look after our own interests.
A lot of these cricket players don't earn particularly good salaries in Britain. Are you not taking advantage of that fact and offering them large sums of money in order to get them to where you want them, but at the same time ignoring the fact that you're prejudicing their future careers?
Well, you know, we've had to go through the back door, and I can assure you that is an avenue that we don't do with much relish, with much enthusiasm. We've got to pay them large sums of money because, in effect, they're professional cricketers, and therefore, by coming out to South Africa, they're going to be banned, and therefore, you've got to compensate them for their loss of earnings.
It was also clear the tourists would be entering a South Africa in turmoil, not that they were deterred. John Embry.
We received a telegram from the South African Cricket Union around about back end of September, beginning of October, informing us that there's a good chance that Nelson Mandela would be released while we were there. And I think at that point, if they could have done, I think the South African Cricket Union would like to have cancelled the trip. But because of the commitments already made by the players and us already being penalised by being left out of test matches, etc., they felt they had to go ahead with it.
Yet away from the millions of pounds allegedly being offered and the pronouncements from politicians, there was also the impact on lifelong friendships. Nigel Felton, the son of so-called Cape Coloured South African parents who had been forced to leave their homeland, and Richard Ellison, the soon-to-be rebel cricketer, have been close friends for years.
This is where I was naive, I suppose, going back to when I grew up with Nigel Felton as a 15-year-old. And I knew him in Kent. I used to stay with his mum and dad. And they looked after me like I was another son. But I never saw or knew enough about... And this is not an excuse. At the time, I just didn't know. And I'm sure Nigel would have wanted to say something to me as a very close friend. And he didn't. He could understand... I use the word the cricketing decision around your job, but he didn't get in my ear around, you know, why his parents had left or why a number of his family had left because of the system.
We got married, I think, 2 months before they went. I had two rebels at my wedding, Greg Thomas and Richard. Yes, I mean, you know what, it's... I wouldn't want to lose my friendship with someone like him who I'd grown up with from the age of 16, and we're still good friends now.
Richard Ellison, like most of the rebels, received correspondence from around the world concerning the proposed tour.
Well, I haven't looked in any detail at this. It's been in my filing cabinet, and whenever I've received anything, I just put it straight in there. What's been written, I've read through at the time. There's one here from a lady to reconsider your decisions. I haven't read this. It's just one I've pulled out. All this, you must know too, that the blacks do not want the tour to go ahead. Why then are you going? Why are you allowing yourself to be bribed to be seen as a supporter of white South Africa money? The answer is simple. If you can't earn enough playing cricket, then do something else. So, I mean, this woman was seriously up in arms, so to speak, and quite rightly, criminals, no doubt. Could argue that they steal to rob to support their families, pay the mortgage, but quite rightly, we don't accept such arguments. People are expected to earn money in a way that seems to be right. Batting or bowling for apartheid is not. So everyone has had a view. This one here. I welcome your decision hugely. Having played tours out there and having seen the huge steps that South African cricketers have taken to put their house in order. So it's not all negative. Well, there was a card. I think I put it, here it is. Well, this is from Peter Hayne. It's a World in Action thing. It's just a card. There's a picture of Peter Hayne on the front. Guess who's been to South Africa? Mike Gatting, soon to lead rebel cricket tour to South Africa, says he doesn't know much about apartheid. To help him out, Peter Hayne, once white South Africa's public enemy number one, made a secret trip back home for World in Action. He talked to sports people all over the country and brought back a clear message for the rebel captain. And there was a program which I assume went out. Monday the 8th of January 1990, and that was sent to me. There's a fax note from somebody from the anti-apartheid movement in Mandela Street in London. Yeah.
Despite letters, protests, headlines in the press and the prospect of an inevitable ban from international cricket, the tourists set off in January 1990. But unlike 1981, when the last English rebel team had landed in secret, this time things were different. André Odendaal.
It was the most controversial because the political movements, mass movements, had decided for the first time not to leave sport to a kind of sanitized protest against it, of saying no normal sport in an abnormal society, but not doing anything. So the ANC and UDF-oriented organizations decided to take it full on, and people went out onto the streets to oppose it.
If the tourists were in any way naive as to how unwelcome they were in South Africa, it soon became abundantly apparent.
The noisy but unthreatening protest by members of South Africa's Catering and Commercial Union took place late in the morning while Gatting and his players were practicing at the nearby Wanderers Ground. The hotel staff resolved not to provide any further services to the rebel team, who are booked at the hotel until Thursday morning before they leave for their first match at Kimberley. When they get there, they face a hot reception. The local anti-tour committee says 500 protesters will attempt to stop the game by walking onto the outfield and staying there.
Unsurprisingly, security was tight. Richard Ellison.
There are always three security guys with us, and if you were going to leave the hotel, one of them went with you in the car and that sort of thing, or one of you were followed. And we were led to believe that within a radius of 5 kilometres, 3 kilometres of wherever we were, there were special forces.
As the crowd, now numbering between 2,000 and 3,000, sang and swayed behind him, local anti-tour organiser Siku Mope spoke up.
My message to Gatting is that you must know that we reject him here in Kimberley. We are telling my Gatting, while there is still time, let him pack his bags and go.
Can you guarantee the safety of the English cricketers?
Okay, we cannot guarantee the safety of the people that are coming here to oppress us.
For 20 tense minutes, with the players on one side of the police cordon, the demonstrators on the other, and the guard dogs straining at the leash, one feared a violent outcome. But then Mike Gatting himself emerged from the sanctuary of the hotel, and in one of the most courageous acts of his turbulent career, he walked across to the demonstrators and smilingly accepted their letter of protest. Soon afterwards, the demonstrators returned to their township on the outskirts of Kimberley. During the demonstration, the tour organizer, Dr. Ali Bakker, had been a picture of unease in the hotel lobby. Now, he could breathe easily again.
We respect totally the right of peaceful demonstration. People who are opposed to the tour were here and were given the opportunity of expressing their viewpoint. I was very happy about that.
Following the events in Kimberley, Captain Mike Gatting came up with a phrase which probably still haunts him to this day.
It was
as I was concerned, there was a few people singing and dancing, and that was it. I didn't know that anything else happened, and we were more concerned with playing the cricket than anything else.
The statement was clearly crass and a PR disaster. But Richard Ellison believes Gatting deserves some credit.
He wanted to find out more about what was going on. And by exposing himself and going out there, albeit with security around him and Ali Bakr and all that sort of thing, he tried to find out a little bit more and he tried to listen to what people had to say.
After 27 years in South African jails, Nelson Mandela is a free man.
Nelson Mandela was released midway through the tour. And with South Africa caught up in a potent mix of jubilation and turmoil, it was decided the tour should be curtailed. With Mandela's release, South Africa was on the way to the end of apartheid and towards unity and democracy. And with it, the country would be welcomed back into the sporting world. There'd be no more need for any more rebel tours. But how are the tours now viewed, some 25 to 30 years after the events? John Embry went to South Africa on both England tours and was subsequently banned twice from playing in international matches.
Yeah, it is a great honour to play for your country, you know, but there are family needs as well. So you have to look at both sides of the coin. It was my decision to go to South Africa. One I felt that wasn't wrong and I don't regret going. The second one I think, for the reasons I went, were wrong. I do regret going. But that's my decision at the end of the day. Nobody else's. It's my career, and I have to live with that.
Richard Ellison.
I'm hesitating because, I've got to sit here and say, no, I've got no regrets. Just around the honest way I've been around why I went. I'm still great mates with Nigel Felton, and we talk about it now in a completely different way. No regrets.
Franklin Stevenson.
Well, I accept that it was a price I paid. It's hard for me to accept in a sense. I mean, not so much hard. I mean, I'll accept anything. It's just reality. And I go on and I live. I've got a wonderful family. I've got, you know, five great grandkids and one on the way. And I can't think. My friend asked me only about last week or so, would I change anything at all in my life? And I looked at him and said, a good thought. I said, no, there's nothing at all that I can change. You know, that. You know, I had a chance to make decisions all the way through my life, and I stood, looked at life, and I made them, and I stand by each and every one.
Clive Rice.
I was proud to captain the side because I wasn't a politician, and I couldn't change the rules in the country here, despite having gone to F.W. de Klerk to see if our sport could do it. But, you know, it was your dream as a kid to captain the side. And I was given the opportunity of doing it. So, yes, you will do it.
Andre Odendaal.
I think at that stage you were either for or against. And people, you know, I think the notion, the wisdom is also written that notion that we could sort of make things better by playing a bit of cricket actually covered up the ugliness of the real story. So I would like to just stick by the fact that the rebel tours deserve to be thoroughly discredited.
It's also worth looking at the bigger picture. The Sri Lankans received 25-year bans, and no one from Oroza, Sri Lanka, played international cricket again. The West Indians were initially banned from cricket in the region for life, and this clearly had a massive impact on the individuals concerned. Franklin Stevenson.
We were punished by our own people. We were punished by our authorities here that had nothing to offer us. The Australians, the English, nobody was ever stopped from playing for their provinces or states or counties. But we were supposed to be. I couldn't even get an entry form to play for a local club here called Maple, which was just next to me, a first division side. They wouldn't give me a form because I'm supposed to be a rebel, you know. So it was like total ostracization, you know, total cast out.
The West Indian lifetime ban was later greatly reduced, resulting in one rebel, Ezra Mosley, playing again for the Windies. But for most, the reduction was of little consequence. Many of the West Indian rebels found life after the tours very hard. In the 1990s, the BBC's On the Line programme tracked down some of them.
Richard Austin, outstanding all-rounder, down and out in Kingston's ghetto. David Murray, world-class wicketkeeper, struggling to conquer drug addiction. Herbert Chang, batsman and brilliant fielder, a recluse, living in squalor. Three cricketers who were paid to play in South Africa and who've paid the price ever since.
I regret it. Personally, I thought it was a bad decision in the end.
The stigma in the black people is that I shouldn't have gone to South Africa.
Recent reports suggest the fortunes of Austin, Chang and Murray haven't improved over the years. Others like Rowe, King, Padmore and Mattis were reported to have left the Caribbean, starting afresh in pastures new. What is clear is that for the West Indians who went, the price paid seems to have been particularly hard. Players from the so-called white nations who toured, England and Australia, did receive bans of varying degrees, and many, after the bans had elapsed, returned to represent their national sides. John Embry, Mike Gatting and Graham Gooch were perhaps the most famous Englishmen who all played again for their country after going on a rebel tour. And it's also worth noting that many years after the tours, several high-profile English rebels reached the higher echelon of English cricket. Graham Gooch captained England and has been part of the coaching setup for the national team. David Graveney was for many years chairman of selectors. John Embry and Bruce French have also been part of the England coaching setup at various points, and Mike Gatting is currently president of MCC. It's clear, then, English cricket has found it easier to forgive and forget than its West Indian counterpart. Of course, the greatest legacy of this period is the fact now in South Africa that no one is barred from watching or playing sport due to the colour of their skin. Let's leave the final word to Andre Odendaal.
This poignant story of Rushdie Majid, who in 1959 went to the mosque that is 500 yards from Newlands Cricket Ground, and when the Group Areas Act was imposed on this area, his family was forcibly removed from Newlands, and they decided never to come back to watch cricket until there was democracy. And for 30 years, from 59 to 89, he read the Argus every day, followed all the Western Province scores and what was happening at Newlands, but kept his promise never to go back to that place until he could enter it as a free human being. And the sort of absolute poignancy of someone having been forcibly removed from the shadow of Newlands, waiting 30 years to come back to reclaim or to get a space as a fully dignified human being is quite amazing. And shows also the power of cricket in shaping our lives and attitudes. So I think it was very just reward that Rushdie eventually became convener of the National Selection Panel and also is currently a life member of Western Province Cricket here at Newlands with the right to freely enter at any time he wishes.
Weekends.